This is an ABC podcast.
Good morning and welcome to AM. I'm Kim Landers. On the program today, as small businesses hit hard by bushfires, push for more government support, we hear how hard it is to keep the doors open and staff employed.
I've had to suggest to a couple of my staff that they wander off to Centrelink. I do employ some school kids, but so they haven't had any holiday jobs.
And beyond bushfires, we take a look at the other threats to some of our most well-known native animals. It's not the first time the royal family has been at a crossroads, and it won't be the last. But the Queen has now brokered a deal to allow Prince Harry and his wife Meghan a more independent life while still carrying out some royal duties part-time. Although there are still plenty of details to sort out. Our Europe correspondent Samantha Hawley reports.
As the world's media gathered on a patch of grass outside Sandringham Estate, locals came to take a look. On a windy and cold afternoon, most were supportive of a prince who wants a private life.
I think it's a bit sad, especially just all the focus, really. I think it'd be nice if they could just live their lives, and I came here for love, too, so I kind of feel for her in a way. In the end, it's a job, but they are people, too, and they have personal lives they can live.
It is hard when, you know, because they are normal people. You know, they've got the right to do what they want to do in life. So I'd say congrats to him for actually putting himself forward. You know, so can't really say much more than that. A lot of people are saying that Meghan was the one that started it all, you know, influenced him. So, you know, I think they've got a right to do whatever they want.
For almost a week, it's dominated the headlines here. They couldn't let pass a suggestion that Prince William had bullied his brother and American wife out of the family fold. In a rare statement, they said, for brothers who care deeply about the issues surrounding mental health, the use of inflammatory language in this way is offensive and potentially harmful. Shortly after the Sandringham meeting ended, the Queen issued a statement expressing regret that the couple won't be full-time working members of the clan anymore, but also expressing support for their desire to live more independent lives. But there's still much complexity to come, and the Queen wants it solved, and fast. There is more work to be done, she says in the statement. I have asked for final decisions to be reached in coming days. Just 20 months since they were married, Prince Harry and Meghan are asking for a very different royal existence than there's been in the past. One where they can conduct royal duties while prospering on the outside as well. Tom Bradby is a journalist with ITV and a friend of the couple who conducted an interview with them last year. He's speaking here on ITV.
He loves this country. He believes in the monarchy. And I think even now it's possible to construct something where, yeah, maybe the half-in, half-out model does work.
Videos resurfaced of a movie premiere in July last year where Prince Harry is seen talking to the head of Disney and touting his wife's skills as a voiceover artist, a sign of the kind of work they may consider. At the beginning of a new decade, the royal family is at a crossroads.
What do you think about the idea that they sort of split their time, part royal, part private?
Don't pass an opinion just yet. That's really up to the Queen.
And the Queen will have the final say. This is Samantha Hawley in Sandringham reporting for AM.
Ukrainian recovery experts have begun examining the wreckage of a passenger jet that was mistakenly shot down by Iran's military last week. It comes as several countries discuss taking legal action against the Iranian government, while the Iranians themselves continue to protest against the government's handling of the tragedy. Middle East correspondent Eric Torchek reports.
Investigators have begun their work, using heavy equipment to extract parts from the blackened wreckage of flight PS752. The Ukrainian Airlines jet was shot down by Iranian air defences last week in what the country's president called an unforgivable mistake. The European Union spokesman, Stefan de Kersmacher, says civilian planes are now being warned not to fly in Iranian airspace.
The recommendation in the current security climate is that overflight of Iran at all altitudes should be avoided until further notice, and this is a precautionary measure.
The foreign ministers of the other five nations whose citizens died on the flight will meet in London on Thursday to discuss possible legal action against Iran. The Iranian government's already dealing with a backlash from its own citizens, who are continuing to protest against the country's military and its religious leadership. Tehran protester Nazli says the government's initial attempt to deny responsibility for downing the plane has angered people already upset by Iran's struggling economy and political repression.
So they don't trust any government. We don't trust anyone now.
The US President Donald Trump and senior American political figures have expressed their support for the protests, leading Iran's government to blame the United States for the unrest. Spokesman Ali Rabieh says Iranians should not trust Donald Trump. In between the mourning of the people of Iran, we witnessed Trump shedding crocodile tears in Persian for our people and claiming he stands by them, he says. The people of Iran will not forget that this is the same person that threatened to bomb 52 cultural sites after killing the most beloved general of this country. The protesters are also aware that just 2 months ago, the government killed hundreds of demonstrators to quell unrest. Iran analyst Holly Douglas from the Atlantic Council says any new mass movement is likely to be met with similar force.
These are people that will hold on to power no matter what. So, I mean, just because people are protesting doesn't mean that this is what's going to lead to something bigger. I mean, I think there would be a lot more bloodshed before, or if anything was to happen, because this is a government that unfortunately is willing to kill.
Iran's internal issues could also distract attention from whatever retaliation the country's planning for the assassination of senior general Qasem Soleimani by the United States. Few people believe the limited Iranian missile strike against US forces in Iraq was the final act of revenge. The problem is, no one can say for sure what the actual retaliation will be or when it will come. From Jerusalem, this is Eric Twarczyk, reporting for AM.
With the impact of bushfires hitting regions that are heavily reliant on summer tourism, business owners are facing the prospect of having no cash flow for up to a year. The federal government will host peak business groups at a roundtable in Canberra today as it mulls over ways it can help. Some in the tourism and hospitality sector want the government to think big and to offer up significant financial handouts instead of more loans. Gavin Coote reports.
Jill Shaddle's Waterfront Cafe in Batemans Bay usually does a roaring trade over the Christmas and New Year period, but power outages and major road closures around the New South Wales south coast have put a stop to that.
I don't know how we come back from this. It's horrendous.
It began with the Kings Highway, the main link with Canberra, which was closed due to bushfires more than a month ago. That slump in tourism meant a 35% drop in Jill Shattle's December revenue. January is shaping up to be even worse. So far it's down 64%.
I've had to suggest to a couple of my staff that they perhaps wander off to Centrelink. I do employ some school kids, but so they haven't had any holiday jobs.
While the Kings Highway remains closed, the region's artery to Sydney, the Prince's Highway, is now reopened following major closures. Adam Zarth heads up the Illawarra Business Chamber, which also represents businesses on the South Coast, Southern Highlands and Snowy Mountains.
We've got businesses right now, particularly in the South Coast, where they're quite removed from Sydney. So with all the goodwill in the world, they're concerned that tourism from Sydney is not going to ramp up again until next December, really. So we're talking about almost a year of foregone revenue. And as we know, most businesses can't sustain more than a couple of months.
There are a range of government support measures available, including grants for eligible farmers and small businesses. But there are concerns the current response is too narrow.
Cash flow has just absolutely hit the fence in these bushfire-affected areas. And, of course, the $15,000 recovery grants, as welcome as they are, They only cover businesses that have been directly have their facilities or their equipment burnt by the fire. So there's a lot of businesses in these regions that are experiencing no visitation right now. So they're very concerned, a lot of businesses, that they can't service their loans for the foreseeable future.
The federal government, which last week announced a $2 billion recovery fund, is now canvassing further measures that could support small businesses. The Small Business Minister, Michaelia Cash, along with the Prime Minister and Treasurer, will today host peak bodies at a roundtable in Canberra. Adam Zarth will be among those at the talks and cautions against the idea of any more concessional loans.
Given that a lot of these businesses will struggle perhaps in 2 years to repay that kind of loan. So we are looking for serious assistance to keep these small businesses open.
In a community heavily reliant on tourist revenue, Batemans Bay cafe owner Jill Shattles worries about whether she can continue trading, but she thinks tax relief could be one sensible option.
I'd like to think that maybe the powers that be would put their heads together and think there are little micro businesses out here that employ people, that keep those people out of Centrelink. Maybe they might like to help us keep those people out of Centrelink.
In a statement, Small Business Minister Michaelia Cash says today's roundtable will take on board proposals that will see these small businesses and the families that run them through the recovery and beyond.
Gavin Coote reporting. You're listening to AM and it's 10 minutes past 8. Amidst the debate about climate change and hazard reductions when it comes to bushfire management, governments are being urged to pay more attention to the knowledge of Indigenous Australians. Some of those ideas were shared at a festival at Cygnet in Tasmania last night, and our reporter Felicity Ogilvie went along.
Dancers acted out an emu hunt. They were welcoming more than 300 people who came to Cygnet to hear how Indigenous Australians used fire to manage the landscape. Local elder Rodney Dillon thanked the keynote speaker, historian Bruce Pascoe, for travelling from his bushfire-ravaged home at Mallacoota in Victoria.
His house is nearly on fire today. He nearly lost his tractor, he's lost his shed, and he's come over here to share his history with us.
Bruce Pascoe is worried about how thick the Australian bush has become.
Old people that I know, both white and black, said that when their grandfathers first came to that country, there used to be about four big trees to the acre. And, you know, I did a little test for myself before these fires started of counting all the trees on an acre of land in the New South Wales forest, and there were 300. And that's far too many trees.
He wants Indigenous Australians to lead fire management by cutting down trees.
Now, a lot of people are going to rile against it, but we really have to go back to the old people's system, and we have to employ Aboriginal people and non-Aboriginal people to go out into the forest and make that forest safe.
Mr. Pascoe spoke on a panel alongside bushfire experts such as Professor David Bowman from the University of Tasmania.
We can, through interventions, adjust the fuel loads, but that's going to require trust and it's going to require money.
The Tasmanian Premier Will Hodgman visited the festival to announce that his government is hiring three Aboriginal rangers to do cultural burning.
In a way that will not only help better protect our communities but also ensure that Tasmanians are also more aware of Aboriginal heritage.
There was one woman on the panel of experts, a land manager at the New South Wales National Park Service, Danielle Flakler.
Women have a place in fire management because we know the country, we know when plants and animals are fruiting or the habitat they require to sustain themselves. We were out there, and we still are actually, you just don't see us. But we know when the right time to burn.
Ms. Flakler says cultural burning needs to be done in patches to protect plants and wildlife.
Felicity Ogilvie reporting. Well, even before this summer's bushfire crisis took an enormous toll on our wildlife, there was concern about the future of some of our best known animals. You probably know that each state and territory has its own native animal emblem, a mascot if you like. But as our reporter Alexandra Beach discovered, many of them haven't been faring too well.
From the koala in Queensland to the Leadbeater's possum in Victoria, the state's animal emblems began to be used in the 1960s, when overseas flight prices were dropping and Australia wanted to establish itself as a tourism destination.
Some states tried to choose one that was probably the strongest tourism angle, and you had New South Wales and Queensland fighting over who would get the koala, but other states picked species which were only found in their state.
Tim Bashara is the Wilderness Society's Federal Policy Director. He's looked into these animal emblems to see how the different states and territories are looking after their mascots decades later. What he's found is not a pretty picture.
6 out of 8 of these faunal emblems are currently listed on the Federal Endangered Species List. That means they're at a clear risk of going extinct.
Many of these species were incredibly rare to begin with, like the numbat in Western Australia. But even comparing their populations from the 1960s to now shows a drop in numbers, reduction in habitat, and increased risks to their survival. The only emblem that doesn't seem to be a worry is the Northern Territory's pig, the red kangaroo. Tim Bashara says he's most concerned about the New South Wales emblem, the platypus.
It's a species that should be safe, but the fact that it's been declining and having a series of local extinctions I find incredibly worrying.
Macquarie University biology professor Leslie Hughes says the plight of the platypus isn't surprising.
Being an aquatic animal living in rivers that are suffering via the drought, it would be very surprising if they weren't being affected by the decline in both the quantity and the quality of fresh water in our river systems.
And she points out there are various reasons for most of the other emblems being in trouble.
In terms of the koala, well, we know that they're very vulnerable and they're extremely vulnerable to being killed in bushfires. There are various estimates of thousands of them dying in the current fires, and of course nobody knows what that figure is.
The states are taking steps to try to conserve their emblems. The Victorian government says it's balancing the recovery of the Leadbeater's possum with the needs of its timber industry, using tools like exclusion zones for timber harvesting and nest boxes in key locations. In the ACT, the Tidbinbilla Nature Reserve has been working to try to save Canberra's endangered emblem, the brush-tailed rock wallaby. The Environment Minister, Susan Lee, says the federal government is also very aware of the issue.
Look, Leadbeater's possum, which is a faunal emblem for Victoria, I have retained the critically endangered listing of the Leadbeater's possum.
But the Wilderness Society is calling for governments to do more, including taking a leaf out of the United States handbook and modelling some of Australia's conservation policies on the work done to save the bald eagle.
Alexandra Beach reporting. Investment managers warn that one of the biggest threats to property values over the coming decade will be the size of their carbon footprint. But so far, there's only one business precinct in Sydney that makes the grade of generating zero carbon emissions. Reporter David Taylor has been looking at what makes a building carbon neutral.
Here at Sydney's Barangaroo, we're in the middle of a rubbish dump. That's the rubbish dump of all the workers in the precinct. And surprisingly, this entire rubbish dump not only doesn't smell that bad, actually has a pretty nice fragrance to it.
Look, at Barangaroo, we like to keep and maintain our areas for where the waste comes down to, being mindful that each bin that comes down is washed out every day and sent back in a spotlessly clean position. So it's like a new bin returning there.
That's Shane Mulcahy, Head of Engineering and Sustainability at professional services firm JLL. His job is making sure the buildings in the Barangaroo business precinct are net zero carbon emitters, which means they run and operate with the goal of maximising sustainability. Even the bin area, where rubbish is turned around quickly and waste is minimised, is climate friendly.
The worst thing we can see is everything just going into landfill and just being not sustainable and environmentally friendly.
The precinct has also done away with cooling towers, a heat rejection system that releases waste heat into the atmosphere and instead sucks in water from Sydney Harbour to cool the building, then releases it back after being treated.
So the heat rejection goes out to the harbour and we have to stay within parameters for the EPA, of course, to make sure that we're doing the right thing.
The Paris Agreement means most sectors of the economy need to be net or nearly net zero carbon emitters by 2050 or sooner to keep average global temperatures from increasing by up to 2 degrees. Reducing waste and emissions from buildings is a logical place to start because real estate represents roughly 40% of all global carbon emissions. The Green Building Council of Australia is the cop on the beat to make sure Australian buildings can meet the challenge. CEO Davina Rooney.
In a new world where there's a huge investor drivers and there's the need for validation, it's very important that there's certifications with clear definitions so people know they're getting what it says on the tin.
Ms Rooney says there is mounting evidence that net zero carbon buildings are easier to sell and more attractive to tenants. That's why AMP Capital's head of sustainable real estate, Chris Nunn, is building up the superannuation giant's stock of green buildings.
That we know our investors care about environment, social governance attributes, particularly in relation to climate change. That's a more solid, future-proof investment.
The problem is that Sydney's Barangaroo is currently the only building precinct that's net zero carbon. To bring all buildings over the line on climate action, the Green Building Council's been armed with a Green Star rating system. And there's a buck in it too. CEO Davina Rooney says the investment return on Green Star certified commercial buildings goes up on average by 13%.
And it's a combination of air conditioning systems, lighting, so that's a huge part of what we see for their operational energy. So that's a big focus for us. And then the management practices, what we'd frame as boring but important, exactly how you set up the site so you use less waste and actually manage toxins the whole way through the process.
With the incentive of maintaining its value, Barangaroo Towers has its own monitoring systems, even for the garbage. Underneath Towers 1, 2 and 3, there's something of a bunker lined with computer screens, showing exactly how the precinct is meeting its climate action targets. Engineer Shane Mulcahy.
We put it into data, so that goes into a cloud and all the analytics piece comes together where I can sit at the desk and see exactly what bins have come out, how much weight it's come out. So as a benchmark, we're setting ourselves right up there, and that's just because we've got all these different streams. Huge education around the occupants is tenant education. Understanding what can and can't go into bins and getting that diversion rate up, in turn increasing our recycle rate as well.
And the building's profitability.
David Taylor reporting. During this month in Antarctica, Australia is doing surprise inspections of the foreign-run bases in the almost 6 million square kilometres of territory that's claimed by Australia. The checkups come as countries jockey for influence and the frozen continent grapples with the pressure of an increasing number of tourists. Kim Ellis is the director of the Australian Antarctic Division.
You know, Antarctica is one of the most important parts of Australia's environmental analysis and responsibilities. And the Antarctic it's the air conditioner of the world. So each time we go down, we see something different and their climate and the environment continues to change. I was first down there in 1979-80. And so what I see every time I go down there is changes both in the environment and the human activity on the site. So my next trip, I'll be down there undertaking a series of Antarctic Treaty inspections, so the formal inspections, and a number of official visits to different stations throughout East Antarctica.
What changes in activity or compliance are you actually looking for when you're inspecting these foreign bases that lie within Australia's territory?
Each of the stations is controlled and operated by an independent country, and they work within the guidelines and boundaries of the Antarctic Treaty. And it sets broad parameters in terms of, you know, peaceful and scientific utilization, so that they're not militarized, that they're undertaking meaningful scientific activities, that the equipment on the stations is there for those purposes. The second major aspect we're looking for is in terms of environmental compliance. They're minimizing the impact of the human footprint on the Antarctic continent.
China has several stations within Australia's territory. Will you be visiting those?
So we don't talk about the stations we're going to visit prior to the visits. We'll be visiting a number of different nations as we undertake these inspections. And then at the conclusion of the inspection tour, we'll notify publicly the stations we visited, and we'll table then reports at the Antarctic Treaty Consultative meeting being held in Helsinki in 2020.
I know you don't want to identify which bases are going to be inspected, but there would be some who would suggest that we really do need to check up on what China is doing in Antarctica, because if you look at the record, for example, of China's activities in the South China Sea, why wouldn't we want to be checking up on them in Antarctica?
We have a checklist that looks at the requirements of the Antarctic Treaty, and we look at every nation that we inspect through the same lens. Are their operations appropriate? Are they undertaking scientific research of a high quality? Are they undertaking the operations in a peaceful way? So are they militarized or not militarized? Are they managing the environment to ensure that they have the minimum footprint? That means, you know, waste management and sewerage and the appropriate management of fuels and other materials. We are looking at every nation.
There's also a lot of pressure from tourism in Antarctica. Numbers have increased in recent years, tens of thousands of people travelling there each year. How much pressure is that going to put on the continent?
I think tourism is one of the most significant issues we'll have to deal with over the next 5 to 10 years. The impact is much greater in West Antarctica because it's much more accessible. So the access through South America and into the West Antarctic Peninsula, it's closer, it's more accessible. But it will grow and it will come into East Antarctica as well. And if you just look on the horizon to see the number of Antarctic or polar specialty cruise vessels that are being built, you'll see that there's this growing trend. We already regulate tourism into East Antarctica, and so we put a very close lens over any applications we receive. And I would have to say that the tourism associations for Antarctica are very strong on compliance. They want to keep going there and they want to protect the environment.
Do you think there's going to need to be a cap placed on tourism numbers?
I think there's probably a range of strategies, and we're in the process of working those through. And I think we are going to have to continue to monitor very closely, not just the numbers, but how they work. Are they burning the right fuels? Are they interfering with wildlife? You know, are they meeting all of the environmental protocols? It's an area that we are turning a very strong lens on, and I think it is going to be a challenge for the Antarctic to take the growth of tourism that will occur over the next 10 years.
Director of the Australian Antarctic Division, Kim Ellis. As bushfires continue, smoke haze is hanging over our major cities. Melbourne is particularly bad today. It's also giving Australian astronomers a hard time, hindering their ability to observe the night sky, although some telescopes are cutting through. Claudia Long has more.
For astronomers, Mount Wurrut in New South Wales is a scientist's dream. Next to the Warrumbungle National Park near Coonabarabran in central northern New South Wales, clear skies, open spaces and not too much light make it the perfect spot to see the stars. Until a little while ago.
The smoke in the air absorbs and blocks the starlight that we try to observe.
Dr. Chris Lidman runs the Australian National University Siding Spring Observatory on Mount Wurrut. The often heavy smoke in the region has been giving them grief, and thanks to the drought, it's not the only problem.
It depends on the wind direction. At this point in time, when the winds are coming from the east, from the coast, we get a lot of smoke haze. But when the winds come from the west, it picks up a lot of dust. It's very dry out there.
Dust is particularly problematic for observers at Siding Spring who use optical telescopes because it tends to cloak their mirrors and even damage them. On nights when the dust or smoke in the air is really thick, it can stop them in their tracks.
One way we test that is we go outside with a torch, and if we can see the torch beam, then we know it's too dusty to operate, so we don't observe for that particular night.
6 hours south, scientists at the Canberra Deep Space Communication Complex in Tidbinbilla have been having a bit more luck.
Now, three stations around the world, here in Canberra, one in Spain and one in California, to provide the 24-hour coverage of the entire universe.
Glenn Nagel works at the tracking station that the CSIRO runs in collaboration with NASA. Unlike at Siding Spring, the site houses four big radio telescopes, some as big as 70 metres in diameter.
And their job is to relay commands to varying robotic spacecraft out across the solar system. So spacecraft that are visiting planets and moons and asteroids and comets, all that those spacecraft require commands so they know what to do every day.
The telescopes receive radio signals back from space, including from famous spacecraft like Voyager 1 and 2. If their names sound familiar, it's because they're the satellites carrying copies of the Golden Record intended for extraterrestrials, featuring the music of Chuck Berry and Mozart. The signals received back by the telescopes aren't the kind you can tune into in your car, but some of them have been translated into audio files. Because the tracking station in Canberra relies on these radio signals rather than optical telescopes, the smoke won't be stopping them.
So far, we can continue our contact with spacecraft across the solar system.
And yes, that includes the Voyagers too. Like a ring in a bell, go, go!
Claudia, along with that report, and that is AM for today. Thanks for your company. I'm Kim Landers.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.